everybody. Thanks for downloading the show. Appreciate you taking the time here. You're here at Garden Fork Radio. My name's Eric, and I'm here with my co-host, Erin. Welcome.
Hi, Eric. Thank you.
You just got off the sailboat?
Yeah, not too well, about a month ago now. But yep, that was our big, big summer adventure.
So everyone, we're going to talk about a couple of things. Erin and I are both sponsored by Troy Built this year. And full disclosure, we're going to talk about their equipment here. And then Erin went on a sailboat race, which I actually know about before I met Erin. And then we're going to do some fall gardening tips. What do you think?
Sounds great to me.
This is totally a sponsored little plug here, but we both recently got some Troy Built equipment that are both powered by the what they call their core motor system. You got a battery-powered blower, and I got the battery-powered string trimmer. What'd you think?
I am in love with this thing, and that sounds like it might be laying it on a little too thick, but we are loving it. I got the leaf blower, and it's so handy. I am not a person who loves string-powered things. I just don't like starting them. And we also had a gas powered leaf blower in the past, and those are really noisy and they're not great for the environment. And we keep this little blower, I just keep it down in the basement on a charger, pop the battery in, and we'll just blow something. I mean, you can use it in the house too, because there's no emissions from it. So we'll like blow out the basement or something, or I'll just grab it up and throw it up on the patio, and it's literally pushing a button. So it is as easy as anything you could possibly imagine to use.
And it's quite the battery, because I have yet to recharge the string trimmer battery. And I still don't quite understand the motor that Troy Built is using. I think my electronic geek friends will understand it more, but it's some sort of a new cutting edge motor. So it works pretty good.
Yeah, I'm really happy with it. I think it's neat. And I think their intention is to, well, there's the blower that I have, the leaf trimmer, and I think there's a hedge trimmer too. Is that right?
And they're coming out with a lawnmower, maybe.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be great. I think it would be great to see them expand that product line if they're able to. I mean, obviously, there's some limitations with batteries, but it is just super easy to use. And I just think people kind of are afraid of power tools sometimes. And
yeah.
I just think it's great. You press a button and it goes and it just does its thing. You don't have to think about it.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of the power tools, but I like it too.
I know you're not.
Well, cool. And so every year you go on this Chicago to Mackinac race?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how did you start doing that?
Well, I was fortunate to just have been sort of born into a family that just races sailboats for fun. And a lot of people, you know, get into sailboat racing in a much different way. But for me, it was just what we did. From the time I was a tiny little kid, on the weekends, our family went sailboat racing. So it's just kind of been a part of my life since I was born.
And then do you guys own a sailboat?
My parents do. Well, our family does. I mean, technically, I think my parents are the owner, but, you know, my brother and I pretty much put in the sweat equity. And then we have a crew of people that we sail with. So we'll sail that race, the Chicago Mackinac race, with 12 people. So there'll be a group of my family. And so, like, this year our crew was my parents and my brother and I and my nephew, my brother's oldest son. And then we have 7 other people who come with us as well who've been sailing with us for a long time.
So walk me through this. Do you guys drive down to Chicago, or do you take the boat down there? Because you live in Wisconsin. Do you take the boat down and then turn around and come back up? Or?
Yep. So we keep the boat up in Wisconsin. And so a few days before the race, which this year started on July 23rd, my brother and my nephew and I will take the boat down to Chicago. It's about a 12-hour trip for us to get down to Chicago. And then we sort of hang out in Chicago and do last-minute race preparation things. The race always starts on a Saturday. And there's a there's about 350 boats that do the race. So there's staggered starting times. And so we usually start around 1 or 2 in the afternoon. So on that Saturday, we hang out, get our stuff together, and then we go out to the race course at probably 11 o'clock in the morning or so.
How do you start a sailboat race? Do you start from a dead stop?
No. So what you do is you start between two points. It's a boat and a buoy that they drop in. And there's you cannot be over the starting line before the allotted starting time for your section. And what you do is you have to sort of sail back and forth, and you time it. So you time it so that ideally you want to be going at full on as fast as the boat can go at the second the gun goes off that you hit the starting line, but not over it early. Because if you're over early, you have to turn around and sail back, which takes a lot of time.
All right, so it's not that's not like a false start like in swimming where everyone has to get back on the platforms. It's just you have to do a do-over.
Exactly. Yep.
And then what do 12 people do on a boat?
Well, since it's 333 miles if you sailed in a straight line to get up to Mackinac Island from Chicago, and of course, boats basically never sail in a straight line, so you usually sail many more miles than that. So it'll take you. You know, it depends on how fast your boat is, but it takes a couple of days to get there. So we will divide the crew into shifts, which we call watches. And we'll do, starting at about 9 o'clock on Saturday night, we do 3 hours on, 3 hours off for the entire rest of the race. So that's one of the things. So basically, most of the time, there's only 5 or 6 people up on deck. So that's kind of why you need as many people as you do, because you need that many people to sail the boat at any given time. And also because there are some sort of things that happen on a boat that sometimes you need the whole crew for sail handling and things, especially if it's a little windier. It's everybody up on deck doing everything, so you just need everyone you can grab.
What happens if everyone doesn't get along?
Oh, it happens. I mean, think about it. You're on a – so – The boat that I sail on is 48 feet long. So you put 12 people in a 48 foot long boat. I mean, that's some close quarters. And you're all, you know, not a lot of sleep. Everybody gets a little tired and maybe a little crabby. You know, I think when you put together a crew, that's one of the things that you really look for is people's ability to get along with other people, even when things aren't going well or when you're crabby or tired or cold or whatever it is. And most of the time, I think people who sail on boats just kind of get it. Sometimes there's little snippy things, but people just kind of move on. You know, I think everyone kind of gets that's part of the deal when you go sailboat racing.
What happens if the wind isn't blowing?
You just keep trying to make the boat go as best you can, and you just wait.
Has that ever happened to you guys?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. It happens. It happens more often than not, at least once or twice during a race. The slowest Chicago to Mackinac race in history was a race that I wasn't on. It was before I was sailing the race. It was 1989, and most of the boats finished on like Wednesday. And to give you an idea of what that is, on the boat we were sailing this year, we finished Sunday night at like 10 o'clock at night, which was a very fast, it was an extremely fast race this year. But I mean, that's how much difference there was. They were looking at Milwaukee, you know, on Sunday night that
wow.
year. So you just, hang in. Sometimes people drop out of the race, but you just keep trying to find a little breeze or do whatever you can to keep a little momentum going and just do your best.
Yeah, it's I followed you on Instagram there, so it's just kind of fun because I was like, I kind of had an idea of what you were doing because this is the second time you've done it that I've been following along. And then the cocktails are nice at the end, right?
Oh, they're fantastic. Nothing better.
Because it's just kind of neat that you do that with your extended family. My family doesn't do anything like that.
Yeah, it's just kind of what we've always done. And it is neat. Every single, this year was my 26th Chicago Mac race. And I have sailed every one of them with at least one member of my family.
Neat.
Which I highly doubt very many people who could say that. Because people kind of tend to jump around on different boats and, you know, crews change and boats change. So it's really fun that's what we do together as a family. So
is there any,
this year was fun. This year was an especially fun one. So
yay. Is there any, kind of like iPhone technology that you guys use for sailing? Are there some kind of apps and stuff or?
Oh, it's unbelievable. What, you know, you can actually, I mean, if you had to, you could absolutely navigate your way up to Mackinac Island on your iPhone. I wouldn't want to because obviously there's some limitations in that, but there are fantastic navigation apps. There's one called iSailor. There's one called Navionics. There's many of them. And they're fantastic. We have those loaded on our iPhones, too, because even though the boat is equipped with a pretty extensive complement of electronic equipment that helps us with navigation and various other things, and we also have the old-fashioned paper charts, we carry those, too.
Yeah.
If something all went to heck, we would still have this stuff on our iPhone, which is pretty cool. Also, weather apps. I'm sure anyone who follows weather knows that there are the apps that you can follow weather on are fantastic, and there are many dedicated apps for wind forecasts. So anytime we're able to, we're looking at those. And then the really interesting one is a race tracking app, and it's called YB Tracking now. It used to be called Yellow Brick. And what the race does is they give every boat in the race a transponder, and you put that on your boat.
Uh-huh.
And anyone with the app can follow the race, and you can see what's going on, and you tap on a boat, and it actually figures out all the handicaps for the boats. So it will, in real time, figure out who's winning at that moment, and they put a little crown over the boat then. And, and so it's always interesting. Now, I mean, this is all new in the past probably 10 years. You know, we used to sail this race, and you'd have no idea how you did. You would finish the race, and of course, since it's all sailed on, the boats all have a handicap,
right?
Just like you would in like golf. You could wait hours before finding out if you did how you did in the race. Now you know almost as soon as you cross the finish line.
How cool is that?
Okay.
So they handicap the boats by maybe age and size and the size of the sails and stuff, I guess.
Yeah, it's not so much age, but it is a handicap based on the displacement of the boat, the length of the boat, the sail plan, all of those things kind of factor in. It's a pretty complicated. There's several racing rules, and the one that race is sailed under is a pretty complicated thing that takes into account all sorts of design features of a boat. And then, of course, so that what that does is that allows everyone to race against each other. So a lot of times bigger boats tend to be faster than smaller boats in sort of general terms. And this means that theoretically everyone is rated equally so that you can be judged upon how well you actually sailed the race, not just on how fast your boat is.
Yeah, because it's also just being able to navigate and tack against the wind and that kind of thing. It's just the skill level's huge.
It is, and that's the main thing with this, you know, with a long distance race like this, is that there's so many factors that go into it. There's the navigation aspect of it, but more than that, there's the strategy aspect of it, and you know, we spend a ton of time before the race studying all of the weather forecasts that are coming. There's even a subscription service for a weather routing company that routes boats for races. And you can subscribe to that. We actually have a new navigation software this year, and on that software, you can download various different forecasts, because of course there's always different forecast models, European model, US model, all these different models. And what it'll do is it'll route you using the information for your boat's performance, and it will route you and show you on a chart where, according to that forecast, it thinks you should go. And, of course, usually these forecasts are so different that they'll be much different from each other. So the question is, where do you want to be? Which one of these forecasts do you believe is going to happen? And if that forecast doesn't develop, what do you do to change your plan as you're sailing up the lake?
How cool is that?
it's far more technical. And then, of course, that's the technical aspect of it. And then there's just the other sort of human aspect of it, which is basic boat handling skills, getting the sails up and down, making the right decision about when to change a sail because the weather is changing, how to position yourself against your competition if you can see them at that time.
Well, what about, I've been concerned about the food. What's with the food?
Oh, we're so lucky. Every boat does food a little bit differently, but we're so lucky. My mom actually makes casseroles and stuff ahead of time. And my mom has sailed, I don't know, probably 28 of these races, more than I have, probably even more, maybe 30. And so she's got it down to a science. And so We eat very, very well on the boat. And we have an oven on the boat and a small, like a three burner stove, propane stove, and a small oven. And so she'll make some casseroles and we cook them, and she's got it all down to a science. And everybody pitches in, obviously, with making everything. So the food's good. Some boats, a lot of boats these days do like freeze dried food.
Yeah.
Which will get you up there. You're not on this boat forever. It's not like anyone's going to starve to death. But there is a morale boost in a fantastic meal because you get hungry. You're outside doing something, you know, all day long. So it's great.
I would love a casserole from your mom. That would be great.
She makes a very good green bean turkey casserole that is sort of the highlight of the trip every year.
How cool is that? I actually, since Labor Day is coming up here, I make a, it's a cold casserole. It's a cold salad. It's a corn and black beans with some spices and stuff. It's like a Labor Day, classic of mine. It's going to be a video coming out at the end of the week here.
Oh, fantastic. I'm looking forward to that. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. Canned beans and frozen corn. It's my favorite food groups.
How can you go wrong?
Well, you know, a lot of times if for lunch, cause I work alone usually, I'll just pop open a can of the Goya brand is popular around here, chickpeas or the white beans, you know, cannellini beans, mm-hmm. and I'll throw a giant tablespoon of pre-made pesto. The Costco pesto is pretty good, and boom, that's lunch, you know, and it's pretty healthy.
Oh, that sounds great. That's interesting. And so you just sort of put that on top of there and mix that. You don't mash that up.
No, I just microwave the beans or the chickpeas in a what's that thing called? In a microwave, in the bowl in the microwave, and I just throw the pesto on the top. I make my own pesto for dinner, but just for me, for quickie stuff, the Costco pesto is pretty darn good.
That sounds delicious.
You know, we're going to go on a tangent here, but I went to the Fairway, which is it's like a medium grocery store, kind of fancy, but guess what that is?
Dog treats.
No, it's chickpea pasta macaroni and cheese.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, I've been avoiding carbs, you know, because I've gained a lot of weight when I hurt my back, and I've been slowly losing weight. But I really love macaroni and cheese, and I thought, oh, maybe this will be okay.
And have you tried it yet?
No, I'm gonna try it tonight because I'm the boss is out at a meeting, a late meeting, so I was gonna make myself these macaroni and cheese. And it's called, the brand is called Bonza, like, you know, garbanzo is another name for chickpea. So I think they had Bonza, like garbanzo bean, Bonza brand, chickpea pasta, mac and cheese.
You know, I find that sometimes it's better to just eat the real thing less frequently than it is to try to substitute something that isn't really going to hit the spot. But I'll be interested to hear what you think about your chickpea macaroni and cheese.
I'll let you know later on tonight. So you're an hour earlier than me, so I can text you late. So.
Yep, that would be great.
So the other thing we were going to talk about is stuff to do in the garden in the fall, other than rake up the leaves. And you are the more, I would say, the decorative gardener, and I'm the more nuts and bolts. So I was curious what you were up to.
Well, I haven't even started. I refuse to think about fall. We've had the most wonderful summer in recent memory. So I'm just focused on like summer continuing, and I don't really want to even think about autumn coming. But when it does come, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that there's kind of a lot of discussion about in gardening circles is whether you should cut back your perennials in spring or fall.
Yeah.
And there are some very well-known gardeners who say, don't cut them back in fall at all. It's much better to let them stand. It's better for the plant. It gives the birds, depending on what they are, sometimes it gives the birds some food. There are other gardeners who say cut them back but leave everything lay on the ground is almost a mulch for winter. And then there's other gardeners who say, I got too much to do in spring and I'm just going to cut everything back now. I would say I do kind of a combination of all those things. I do leave things like coneflower standing because the birds do like to eat that. And it's kind of pretty to have something standing in the garden.
Yeah,
for
those
winter.
Brown kind of spiky flower heads.
Mm-hmm. And then, but if I didn't cut everything back, I mean, if I waited till spring, I have so much to do in spring, I would I'd never get to any of it. So I cut back a good amount of stuff, and I try to clean up what I cut back just because I don't really care for a messy garden in spring when it can be so muddy. It's a little hard to get in there sometimes. So I sort of do a combination of those things. So that's sort of number one, is people always sort of wonder, what do you do when everything's kind of dead in fall?
You know what I've noticed is I have a lot of brown-eyed Susans in addition to the purple coneflowers. And in the dead of winter, they're still sticking up through the snow. And when the wind blows, it'll rattle the brown-eyed Susans to the point that it drops some of its seeds. And the chickadees are year-round near me, and they will go snap up that seed.
Yeah, exactly. So it's great stuff for the birds. It's also a good way to make sure you have a lot of reseeding going on if you're looking for that, or else you have some weeding to do in spring. But no, it's good for birds. And I like to leave grasses stand too. I think grasses are really pretty in winter. And it's just nice to have something to look at out there. I don't have a ton of evergreens in my yard, so things can look a little Spartan in winter if you don't leave a few things standing.
Yeah. All right. What's next?
For me, winter or fall is a big, I mean, I know you said rake up leaves, but it's a big compost time for me. It is like, and this year I got a chipper shredder, and all of my leaves are going into that chipper shredder this year, and I'm going to shred them down. The chipper shredder I got, it's a Troy built. It shreds things down to, it's super fine. So I know they will break down, and once there's some heat on them, they'll break down in probably 6 weeks, I would guess. So I'm actually kind of looking forward to collecting a whole bunch of leaves this year and shredding them all down.
Yeah, because last year, you know, the last 2 years, I didn't mulch any leaves. I just blew them into the woods and along the stone walls and everything. And I noticed that blowing them all, it really compacted those areas. And there's some little delicate plants and stuff that didn't grow very well. So I'm going to start mulching again.
Yeah, mulching is so good. And I just love that. That is such, I mean, even if you don't make it into proper compost with mixing of the greens and everything, leaf mold is, like, I think one of the most amazing garden amendments you can find. I went to a garden last year on a tour nearby. There's a lot of, I don't happen to have this, but a lot of gardens in this area are heavy clay soil. And this was one of them, and her garden was beautiful. And I asked this woman who had been gardening here in that spot for 30 some years. I said, you know, what's the secret to your soil? And she said, leaf mold. She said, I go around, I collect every neighbor's leaves I can possibly find. I let them all rot down. She said, I cover my garden in rotting leaves, which is leaf mold, every chance I can get. She said, my soil is light and fluffy and amazing. And if you dug down 2 feet, you would come in, because that was where her soil had been amended to at this point. She said, you would come across, you know, heavy sodden clay soil. So I love leaf mold, and I just can't get enough of the stuff. And I'm a little obsessed with making my own compost. So I get really excited about that stuff.
Yeah. Like, Radio Rick talks about driving around in the fall, and his neighbors all they rake up their leaves, and they put them in the brown paper bags. And it's like, and then he picks them up, and he swears that everyone looks at him like, what's wrong with that guy? You know? And to him, it's free fertilizer, you know?
It's the best stuff. And I use it too in my, a lot of times I have like perennials that I haven't gotten around to planting, or last year I bought several, I think 18 very, very small boxwood plants. I would like to have a boxwood hedge at some point somewhere on my property, but boxwood plants, if you've ever tried to go buy boxwood, it's very expensive.
Yeah.
So I bought very small boxwoods. I'm growing them out in gallon pots, and I hope that, you know, in maybe another 3 years or so, I'll be able to plant those out. But for now, they grow in gallon pots. I water them, I fertilize them. And in the winter, what I do is I stick them, I bury them in my raised bed. And then I cover the whole thing with shredded leaves.
Yeah, because they'll get frost. They'll get frostburn, frostbite.
Yeah. Yep, and the whole thing, and it protects them. And even though they're not, you know, it gives those roots a little bit more insulation. And everything makes it through the year. So if there's anything that I haven't gotten around to planting, or this fall, I've got a lot of dividing to do, but I don't quite know where all those plants are going to go once I divide them. So I think I'm going to pot a lot of them up and just heal them into the raised bed and cover the whole thing up with shredded leaves. And I've never had anything go wrong with that system.
Nice.
So That's that. But that's the other big project I have on the agenda for gardening for this fall, which is dividing. I learned a bit of a lesson. I seem to have to relearn this all the time, which is that I always plant too close. And yeah. It's great when you're first starting. I just have no patience. So I have a hard time imagining waiting 5 years for it all to grow in and look good. So I tend to plant things a little closer than I should. And so when I redid sort of the backyard, I don't know, 4 years ago, you know, at the time everything looked really sparse. Well, this year it's all really fully come into its own. And now I need to go in there and divide a lot of things because it's a bit cramped in there.
I have some big hostas that are just kind of falling on top of each other now. So I have to kind of go in and be kind of brutal about it next spring.
Yeah. You know, the good thing is that hostas are so forgiving. I've chopped up a couple of them in the process of dividing them. When I didn't really want to, I had to for various reasons. I had to move. And they just spring right back, and they're better for it. I mean, in a year or two, they're back to the size the original plant was.
Yeah, I just my trick is to use a very sharp shovel, and it's good to go.
Sharp is always the key.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Well, that's all on our list. Did you have anything else, or?
I don't think so. What else are you doing in your garden this fall?
I'm actually gonna make a video about it. This is Labor Day. I have a mix from Fedco of fall and winter greens. It's a mix of lettuces and cabbages and beet greens and stuff. And I'm going to spread that over one of the beds, and then that'll grow because I have the soaker hose system for it to water it automatically. But it will grow probably into November, December because I'm going to drop the mini greenhouse on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Great. What a great idea that is.
Because I think people just kind of stop. You know, the tomatoes die. You know, the squash stops growing. And then they're just, okay, that's it. But if you just think back a couple of weeks, you can start some cold, hardy seeds and then use some kind of hoop house and you're good to go.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Actually, I think this year, one of these, like maybe next weekend, I'm going to actually sow some more lettuce. I didn't really get on top of that much this spring, and I really missed it. So I'm going to try to see if I can't squeeze out a quick leaf crop yet this fall.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, Aaron, if people want to come find you, where do they find you?
They find me at The Impatient Gardener, which is theimpatientgardener.com.
Cool. Well, thanks for taking the time. I know it's the end of the day there, but I appreciate that. And we'll have you back on soon.
Thanks so much. It's always good talking with you, Eric.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. The best way to help out Garden Fork is to tell your friends about us. And if you have a question, it's radio@gardenfork.tv. See ya. Garden Fork's theme music is used under license from uniquetracks.com.